ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
And joining us for a look at the week in science is Charlie Lineweaver. He's back. Charlie, good day. How are you? Welcome back to Nightlife.
I'm fine and I'm on the earth. Just like you.
Well, exactly. We had to worry that for a while you might have shot yourself off into the cosmic void.
Well, when somebody asks me, hey, where are you from? I say, I'm from outer space. And they kind of get a look at it, and then they think about it and say, yeah, I guess we're all from outer space.
We're all from outer space in a way, aren't we? That's right, we are.
In the most profound way you can be from anywhere.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Someone said, I think someone was asking on a program the other day that I was listening to, they said, if the universe is expanding, why isn't the sun and the moon getting further away?
Right. And this is a question I've been asked 100 times.
100 times, I imagine.
100 times. And we have the answer.
Yes, exactly.
Woody Allen said, "Yeah, hey, if the universe is expanding, isn't Brooklyn expanding?"
No, it's Brooklyn's not expanding.
No, it's not.
No.
Let me give you the short answer. The short answer is that anything that's gravitationally bound or held together by molecular forces like your body is not expanding.
No.
And that includes Brooklyn, that includes the Earth, that includes the solar system, that includes our galaxy, and it even includes the local group, which is our galaxy and the nearest galaxy,
that's right.
Andromeda.
That's
so
right.
That local group is not expanding. But beyond that, a factor of 10 beyond that, that's when you get into the expansion of the universe.
Exactly. Now, I said you was worried that you might have blasted yourself into a cosmic void, but there are problems of living in a cosmic void, aren't there?
There sure are, and this I don't know. You know, as a cosmologist, one of the main goals is to figure out how fast the universe is expanding. This is called, and the number that we measure is called the Hubble constant.
Mm-hmm.
So, and recently there's been some problems about, one group says it's 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And a megaparsec is about 3 million light years. So what that means is if you look at something that's 3 million light years away, then on average, those objects will be moving away at 67 kilometers per second. And if you look twice that far, instead of 3 million light years, 6 million light years, they're moving at 2 times 67, et cetera, et cetera. So the further things away, the faster they're moving away. But what that number is something that we argue about. And so basically in the last few years, there's been measurements of 67 kilometers per second per megaparsec and 70 or 69 and 74. And these people are arguing, oh, now – if the error bars were large, people wouldn't argue. But the error bars are really small now, about 1 or 2 kilometers per second. So this is called the Hubble tension. Now, what I should back up and say, what this is measuring is the average expansion of the entire universe. But here's the catch. If we are living in a void, voids will expand even faster because they're less dense, less matter to hold it together. If we're living in an overdensity, then the expansion will be smaller. And so depending on what type of inhomogeneity we are in locally will determine our local measurement of this expansion. And so that adds a problem to it. And we're not quite sure how big this local void might be. There is increasing evidence that we're in a void. And that might explain some of this tension in the Hubble value.
Mm. Hey, a lot of people I know are reading these books, or the book, The Three-Body Problem. I mean, there are others in the series, and it's been made into a Netflix show as well, I know.
Have you seen the Netflix show?
I haven't seen it, but
I've heard there's also a Chinese version of it that might be even better than the next Netflix version.
Yeah, the books themselves are loved a lot, I know. Tell us about the science and science fiction of this.
Okay, so it's called the three-body problem. Now, if you're a physicist, the three-body problem is just an interesting issue because Newton, you know, about 400 years ago, said, you know what, with my calculations of gravitation, you can predict in a two bodies that are orbiting each other where they will be in almost in the infinite future. And so the two-body problem is predictable.
Mm-hmm.
But when you add a third body to that, then it becomes chaotic and you cannot calculate it with a pencil. You need to kind of simulate it on a computer and it still becomes unpredictable. It becomes chaotic. And that's why the three-body problem is interesting. Now, the other interesting fact is that the Chinese author said, you know what? The closest star system to the sun is a three-body problem. It's Alpha Centauri A, B, and then there's Proxima Centauri, and Proxima is the closest one. But the problem is that that is not a chaotic system. Although it is a three-body problem, two of the bodies are not about the same mass. They're orbiting each other. We go about around each other in 80 years. But then Proxima is so far away that it is doesn't perturb the other two in any way. It's also smaller. It's like 40% of the mass of the other two. And so that's a three-body problem, but it's not chaotic one. And so he kind of exaggerated the chaoticness of the people who live on this Alpha Centauri. By the way, in the book, the star system is also happens to be 4 light-years away from the sun. And so he stretches things by saying that the Alpha Centauri system is chaotic, and it certainly isn't. But he uses that to say, oh, these civilizations come and die because, you know, the climate is really great for a while and then turns into searing heat or just everything freezes. And so that's a gross exaggeration of the climatic instability of the planets that we know are in this system. So the other thing,
Why is it so difficult with three? I mean, I understand what you're saying about the three, but why is the mathematics of working out the forces acting on three bodies so difficult?
Well, I guess it has to do with feedback in the sense that, so you have two, let's suppose you have two going around each other nicely, and then let's throw in an arbitrarily a third body about the same mass. And what that does is that changes the body one, and then body one changes two, and two changes three, and then three changes one. So you have this very strong nonlinear feedback of one changing the other, changing the other, changing the other, and I guess you have...
But surely at some point it settles down, doesn't it?
Well, in the case of the real three-body, the Alpha Centauri system, it has. But if... alternative to settling down is to going tossing out one of the stars,
right.
And then the two that are remaining get harder; they get closer together, and then you only have a two-body problem, and then it's predictable again.
Right.
But that's about all I know about that issue.
Hey, climate change is affecting everything, as we know, including from what we eat to what we wear. How is climate change slowing the Earth's rotation?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting issue about. Well, first, I guess the main physics involved is the ice skater, right? Mm-hmm. The ice skater is spinning around. She has her arms out. And if she pulls her arms in, she goes much faster. And if she puts her arms out, she goes slower, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, instead of the ice skater, think of the Earth. When material gets closer to the equator, it's like she's putting her arms out. And that means you go slower. And if you have less stuff at the equator and more at the poles, then you go faster for the same reason that the skater goes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So now the Earth is a dynamic system, and so it has ice at the poles, for example. And if that ice melts, the water will flow towards the equator, and that will make the Earth slow down. Also, the moon creates a tidal bulge, that creates tidal friction, and that makes the Earth slow down as well.
If the water melts, why does the water go to the equator? Because that's where it's spinning the fastest. So
yeah, if you take water in a bucket and then spin the bucket, you'll see that it goes towards the outside. It gets as far away from the axis as it can.
That's the whole thing about the Earth being fatter in the middle, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, that's right. The Earth is kind of fat in the middle. Now, what's interesting, though, is about 12,000 years ago, the poles, there used to be a glacial, and then it melted, and then the water moved towards the equator, and it slowed the Earth down. But now what's happening is the Scandinavia is rebounding. So the water moved quickly to the equator, but now the continents are making the Earth more spherical as they rebound because the weight has been lifted from them. Uh-huh. And that has the opposite effect. That makes the Earth spin faster. Then you have something else. You have the liquid outer core. Now, that liquid outer core has these currents in them that create the magnetic field. It's also solidifying on the inner solid core, which makes it pull like the skater pulling in her arms, which makes the Earth go faster. So you have these different effects pulling in different directions. Interestingly, in general, you can think of the Earth as slowing down. For example, 4 billion years ago, the length of the day used to be about 5, maybe 8 hours, maybe even 5 hours, much, much shorter than it is today.
Wait, how long ago?
This is about 4.2 billion years ago.
Oh, okay. Mm.
And we can do the various ways of measuring the length of the day as a function of time. But
Would it matter if we slowed down? I suppose. Well, the days would and nights would get longer, wouldn't they?
Yes, everything gets longer.
Everything gets longer.
Used to have an 8-hour day. Now we have a 24-hour day.
Gee, that's no good. You have to work harder.
No, we're going to have a 3-day weekend. All right. Anyway, there's these different processes producing longer and shorter days. Mm-hmm. Now, up until 1955, the Earth's rotation was the best clock we knew. Yeah. And if you do the math, 24 hours times 60 minutes times 60 seconds, you get 86,400 seconds in a day. Mm-hmm. Let's call that a solar second. It's defined by the day. But if the day is getting longer, the solar second is getting longer, right? Mm. But 1955, cesium clocks were introduced, atomic clocks, much more accurate than the rotation of the Earth. And so now we have all of a sudden two types of seconds. One is a solar second. The other is like a physical cesium clock second. And they're not the same length anymore because the solar second is getting shorter and longer depending on the rotation of the Earth. So they have to calibrate these two. And for the past about 40 years, 50 years, they've added leap seconds at the end, at December 31st, at the end of the year, they've added another leap second. And that, so far, has kept the clocks all over the world in sync between the solar second, solar mm-hmm. clock, and the mm-hmm. atomic clock. But now, interestingly, the Earth seems to be speeding up the rotation because of something in the inner core, probably. So they, and based on this, they said, you know what? For the first time in history ever, we're going to have to add a negative leap second because the rate of the Earth is spinning is getting faster. And then they said, we only have a few years. We only have like 2 or 3 years to figure out how to add a negative leap second. We've never done this before because everybody else was used to just adding a leap, positive leap second. But then along comes, here's the climate change issue. The climate change is getting the water from Greenland and Antarctica into the oceans. And then that water is going to the equator. And that is slowing down the Earth a little bit. And so these computer programmers, instead of having 3 years to figure out a negative leap second, they will have about 6 years. And so climate change has the positive effect of giving these computer nerds twice as much time to figure out how to do a negative leap second.
How about that?
how about that? How
now,
about that?
Early humans didn't worry about these things because they didn't know about them, I suppose. But anyway, early humans apparently had spread as far north as Siberia.
Well,
400,000 years ago. I didn't even think. Oh, you mean the early humans, like the Neanderthals and
No, early humans are different from Neanderthals. Neanderthals and humans diverged about 600,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. When they say early humans in this report, they're probably talking about Homo erectus.
Okay, and not sapiens, but erectus, yes.
Well, this is a wonderful thing. You know, I told you I just went to Switzerland. I was just in the National Museum of Switzerland. And for the first time in my life, I saw the phrase Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's interesting because there's a giant debate and these anthropologists are, is it Homo Neanderthalensis? Are they a different species? Yeah. Or is it Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis? They are different subspecies but the same species. And and you know that you have 2% Neanderthal in you, so do I. And we kind of say, hey, if they've had sex and we have 2%, then we're the same species.
Must be the same species.
You know? Must be the same species. Now, here's the interesting twitch, though. We do not have Homo erectus DNA. So we do not know if it should be Homo erectus or Homo sapiens erectus. But in the Swiss Museum, they had Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis acknowledging this 2% and saying, hey, we are the same species. The next step, I think, it will come as soon as we get erectus DNA is that, oh, by the way, you know, you got 1% erectus in you. But the bottom line is there's a new discovery of a site, and it was newly dated at 417,000 years ago. Just to give you a background, Homo erectus is the most, the most successful human species in the sense that it lived from 2 million years ago to about 100,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so this site, they don't have any bones, they don't have any teeth, but they do have what are called primitive stone tools, and therefore they think it was erectus. But if they had it this far north in Siberia near Yakutsk, then they say, hey, they could have just gone across this, you know, the Siberian over to Alaska and got into the New World. But currently, the oldest human remains in the New World are about 33,000 years.
That's right. That's right. Remarkably modern, actually, isn't it? I mean, The Australian evidence of is much older than the Americas.
Yeah. That's right, 65,000 for Australia and about half that for the New World. On the other hand, you know, they do have Homo erectus right in neighboring Indonesia, much, much earlier, like 1.4 million. So I think Homo erectus moved out of Africa very early and spread maybe even all the way around the world, and maybe I would suspect even to the New World, but we have no evidence for that yet. And so I suspect there's a Homo erectus horizon that's going to really sweep over the anthropologists and say, oh, yes, we do have Homo erectus in us. They are the same species. And yes, they did make it to the New World a million years ago or something.
Interesting.
But that's me speculating.
Hey, just finally, what does your brain do in blind spots? There's an experiment you can try.
Yeah. So have you ever put a little dot on a white paper and tried to find, you know, you close one eye, you look straight ahead, and you hold this dot around, you move it around. If you look straight ahead, and the dot has to be about 10 degrees off from straight ahead, but you can't look at it. You have to look straight ahead, and then you move the dot till it's about 10 degrees away from straight ahead. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done this?
No, I'm going to do it now.
Okay. Well, it takes a little bit more time than we have here.
Yeah, okay.
But what our listeners should do is take a piece of white paper, put a spot on it with a pen, and then try to find your blind spot. It'll take you a little bit minute. But again, you have to have one eye closed, the eye looking through straight ahead, and then off about 10 degrees at the same height straight ahead is you will move it around and you'll find your blind spot. Now here's what you do.
Well, you can't see the dot anymore.
You can't see the dot anymore. That's right. But don't look at the dot. You have to look straight ahead and then move the dot around so in the side view it disappears. So then you found your blind spot. You know approximately where it is. Then what you do is make this dot bigger. And you make it from 1 millimeter, 2 millimeter. You make it. When I did it, I made it all the way to a diameter of about a centimeter. Okay, so you get this dot, pretty big dot now. It's a centimeter and you can still find the blind spot. And you're still not there. It disappears. Now here's the funny thing. You instead of making a dot 1 centimeter across, you make a ring around an empty – you make a disc around this 1 centimeter. In other words, the inside the centimeter is still white like the paper. Outside, you make a disc that's dark. And then you find your blind spot and you do the same thing you had been doing. And what you will see is that your brain, instead of seeing a ring – you will see a solid dot because your brain has filled in the ring, says, hey, I can notice what's around this. It's dark. Therefore, I'm going to fill in the rest of it with dark.
Hey.
and this shows you exactly what your brain is doing. It's filling in the best way it can. And what you've done is kind of fooled it in the sense that you've made a ring and a white. You know, if you look at it, you say, oh, that's a ring. But if you put it in the blind spot, it turns into a solid dot. And your brain has done that by itself. And it's an interesting experiment to help you know what your brain is doing.
You can try this at home.
Yes, you should try it at home. It takes a little while to figure out where the blind spot is, but once you've found it a few times, it gets easier. And then you make your dot bigger, and then you make a ring around that size dot. But in other words, you have to remove the dot and then make a ring around it. Yeah. And that's the ring that gets filled in by your brain.
Try it. Yes. Charlie, always fantastic. Thanks. Right. Good to have you back.
All right. Thanks, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.